We kept talking about trash fish, and I was wondering if you could tell me what species are trash fish?
Basically, the species that are considered trash fish or rough fish are species that are not game fish. Now, the two different categories is, like, for example, game fish are bass being the number one game fish, speckled perch, brim, bluegills, striped bass, chain pickerel. There may be one or so that I've left out of that, but those are the game fish. Now, rough fish, trash fish, are catfish. In some parts of the state, a catfish is considered a game fish out in the panhandle section, but that is the only place. Here, it's catfish, gizzard shad, garfish, mudfish, or bowfish, whichever you prefer. Let's see. There may be one or two others that I may or may not have.
And the porgies then? But they're the
pogies. They're also. But see, they're not what you would call native to the fresh water.
Oh, they.
No, they migrate to and from the.
Oh, I can't believe these are your kids. I mean, they're weeny and they're little.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
That was the truck. Yeah.
Oh, she painted this.
Yeah,
this is beautiful with the fish on it. That's
great.
Yeah,
that was a real, that was the thing.
Wow. Those are great cartoons.
Yeah,
she should go into business. Is this health from the river?
No, this truck, when I bought it, it belonged to a guy back over here that raised citrus fruit.
Hmm.
And he didn't use any artificial fertilizers or chemicals on his groves. And he advertised as natural natural food and so forth. And we bought the truck from him through another person. In other words, he sold to somebody else, and then I bought it and I got it. But anyway. We got that thing.
So
Cindy
cute.
Painted those little cartoons on it.
Those cartoons
and everybody,
are great.
When I had the truck repainted over, everybody said, "Oh, you shouldn't have done that. The cartoons. What happened to Snoopy?" They was really upset that we get away with the cartoons.
Go into business painting trucks, I think.
I've got to show you these.
Let me see.
Look at Kirsten with that catfish.
That's the 38-pounder.
Oh, that's unbelievable. It really is just as big as he is.
That was the one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. And here's several of them together.
They're huge. They look like they're going after him. Don't they? He didn't look too worried, though. Oh, what a sweet boy. Look at his sweet face.
Isn't that something?
Gosh.
We was talking about that last night. Doggone
it,
why do they have to grow up?
Really? Well, they still look kind of cute, but not the same way. Oh, those are wonderful. That old Studebaker is just a gem.
Yeah.
Is it rusted at all?
Oh, yeah.
It
rust
is.
Has got it real bad.
Mm.
Yeah.
Bet those would be worth something, a Studebaker truck that vintage.
It would have if it was original in good shape,
yeah.
But it's not original. I made some changes on it. But it got us, it did the job for us for quite a while.
That's neat.
Yeah.
The shapes of those old trucks.
Yeah,
really
they have a character to them now.
Mm-hmm.
That we was talking about last night, the truck. Now I told them, I said, "Well, I'd like to have a new Dodge truck." And Devin was saying, "Oh, they don't have any looks to them." He said, "That's the worst looking truck there is." I said, "They all look like boxes anymore. They don't have any character." So.
Did this one have a floor start?
Yeah, it did.
It
the
did.
Starter was
yeah.
on the clutch. You had to mash the clutch
right.
in and then push it real hard to engage a starter.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. That's neat.
Yeah.
Did you modify that? Or
yeah,
did,
we
yeah.
took the old motor out and put another motor in. We put a Chevrolet engine in it.
Oh, a lot easier
yeah.
that way.
Yeah, and we put an automatic transmission in.
Getting parts for Studebaker engines now might be
Well, good. Yeah, it would be very difficult. Yeah,
that's really...
But anyhow, that was our truck for lots of years.
Was it the family car, pretty much?
Too? Yeah. Well, I say it was. No, we had a car. Yeah, we had a car. That was our work truck.
Well, let me see. I was talking about trash.
Yeah, fish, trash and then, fish.
Oh yeah. When they were haul sanding the river, they'd get those trash fish, uh-huh. And then would they bring them in for bait?
Yeah, they'd bring them in.
They wouldn't throw them back.
No, no. Okay. They would bring them in, and then they would cook them up, and then they would take them back out and pour them back out in the lake, and that was the bait for the following day's catch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So that's how they...
That's how they kept them out, yeah.
And so the commercial fishermen felt that they were getting all that... those trash fish out and leaving more room for the sports fish.
Yeah, but I don't think they had that thought in mind when they were doing
it.
It didn't register that that's what was happening. Yeah, yeah.
But it might have worked that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I thought maybe you could describe kind of a typical day when you're fishing. Like how many hours you end up putting in, you might get up and go out, and how long it would take you to like run your traps, and then what kind of things you do, you know, then you clean them or sort them, and that takes how long, and then after that, maybe you repair equipment or do some kind of maintenance. Maybe you could kind of describe that, which I would have seen if the wind had been a little bit calmer.
Well, maybe it'll go down after a while, but anyway, I doubt it as strong as it's blowing now. But anyway, well, for example, catlining. Now, we was talking about catlining. That's about an 18 to 20 hour a day job, actually, guys. Because, I say catline because that probably consumes the most time, most effort for that particular fishery. Starting with the morning, you would get up early and you would go out and you would pick up your lines. If you're the kind of fisherman who jumps your lines from place to place. Now there are some who leaves lines in one place, but most of it is done, or when I was doing it, most of it was done with the jump lining. And I think I described jump lining earlier as shoreline fishing, but that's not necessarily the case. You also jump line in the deep, fishing along the bottom. But, for example, you would go out in the morning, first thing, and pick up your lines and bring them back in. And depending on how many lines you fish, would be X number of hours, but you can figure probably maybe 20 minutes per line, 20 to 30 minutes picking up each line. That's to get it in the boat. Now then...
That seems fast. I would think it would take a lot longer.
It goes pretty rapid. And then you would get your lines in, you would come in, and you would dress the fish. Depending on the catch, would depend on how long it takes you to dress them. Usually, catline fish dress faster because they're larger fish. You catch a larger average fish on catlines than you do in the wire traps. But anyway, dress the fish. Then you would go catch bait, shrimp. And from here, we would have to go to Lake George or the St. John's River over in Georgetown and catch the shrimp because there's no shrimp in this lake.
You use a big
scoop with a small mesh net, eighth of an inch mesh net.
Small
net, and it's looks like a big dip net with a long handle, and it's got the small mesh, and you push that net through the eelgrass along the edge, and that's how you catch the shrimp. Okay, after you catch the shrimp, then you come back. In the meantime, your helper has probably put the lines back on the racks, put them on the boxes, and you're ready to start all over again. So when you come back with the shrimp, you bait the lines. When you get the lines baited, then you go back out late in the afternoons, dusk, and put the lines out, and then come back in. And then when you finish that, you sit down and you eat, of course, during after you've eaten supper, you usually sit down and you start tying up stagings. And staging is the little drop that hangs from the swivel to the hook. That's that piece of line between the swivel and the hook.
How do you spell that?
S-T-A-G-I-N-G, stagings, that's what we call them.
Huh, Okay.
And you tie stagings, and then, because you're always having a place from one reason or another. A catfish, if he swallows a hook, then his rough mouth will saw the thing so that it's rough and you got to change it, or a crab will bite it off or whatever. But anyway, and that's just about a typical day in catlining. Now, however, if you've had your lines out stationary, and by stationary, that's the one that you've left in place, you go out and you run over it, and as you run over, you bait it back that particular time that you're running. And that is really time-consuming when you bait on the water.
I bet.
Yeah, lots of time involved in that. With exception if you're running what they call fishing empty hooks. Now, that's a form of catlining where you just put the hooks out, and they don't put any bait on them.
And that works?
And it works, yeah. Only at certain times, and we have different theories about why it works, but it works.
Then, that would be great if it worked all the time.
Well,
what
that's
a great way to fish.
Yeah,
I mean.
But it only works at certain times. And the tinfoil, they put tinfoil on the hook, little squares of tinfoil, like I was describing the soap earlier, three-eighths of an inch. They do the same thing with tinfoil. This works on catlines. And this is the stationary type fishing. Most of it's done either with empty hooks or with the tinfoil on the hook. Like I said, we have our different theories of why that works, and mine is we have blind mosquitoes in this area, and my theory is the larvae is the favorite food of the catfish, and the larvae starts moving around and it gets hung on, it clings to the hook or whatever, and my theory is that the fish are just feeding and they just happen to suck up a hook when they're sucking up these larvae.
Smart. That's neat.
But anyway, it works, and like I say, only certain times of year. Now, trap fishing, we're allowed to fish 80 traps per license.
Mm-hmm.
Per licensed fisherman, you can fish 80 wire traps. A typical day, I get up in the morning, go down and take the bait down and load the bait in the boat. Now, the bait is the soybean chips. Go out and raise the traps, and I try to raise probably 40 traps per set. Now, I say per set, okay? I fish different sets, and one set has approximately 40 to 45 traps on it. Now, I'll go out and raise those.
A set is a line?
That's a line.
That are all
well, it's not. That's what you would call a set is like, for example, the main line, the trunk line, and then the drops off, but that's not 45 drops off of this one line.
Oh, okay.
Now, that's, I have anywhere ranging from 8 to 12 traps per line, per main line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I'll have, like, for example, I'll have a line here, and another line here with different drops off of the line. I can show you better, like, right this right here. This is, okay, now these are my sets, as you can see, north and south, okay, and this is a line, right?
Wow.
So there's drops off each one of these lines, and this is basic location. I had specified different locations and so forth, and this is, if you went to this particular set, this is exactly how the lines lay at this set. This little dot here is the cork that you would pick it up, and this line runs back this direction. That would be, if you was looking at it north and south, this line would run to the west.
Mm-hmm.
This line runs to the west. This line runs to the east, okay, like so. So the little dot is the cork that you pick up the line with. And then
great.
This is a set, this is a set, and this is a set, okay?
Right.
Like that. So that's how... that's how I distinguish my sets. Now, the line, it takes, depending on how many traps I change, and I try to change a few traps every time I go out to keep fresh traps out. Now, fresh traps is a trap that I have just tarred.
So that you're not leaving one?
Yeah, so that I don't go out there and all of my traps all of a sudden are all dirty.
Right.
So I try to keep some clean, fresh traps out. Depending on how many traps I change and how many fish I catch and so forth depends on how long it takes. Average, about 3 hours to raise those traps and bait them and get them back in the water. Okay, then we come in, and there again, depending on how many fish we catch, depends on how long it takes to clean those fish. As you see the other day, once the four of us get into it, it don't take too long to clean them. But,
if you don't have that help.
When it's just me and Cindy, it takes us quite a while. We figure we can dress maybe, depending on size. Now, trap fish, normally you catch a smaller grade fish in the traps, not because of anything except that's the way it's been. I can't tell you why, but
so you'd want to fish traps now because you get paid more for the smaller fish than the larger ones, or
yeah, you get more, but it evens itself out because you put more work into the small ones. So we would still rather catch the bigger ones because the less time involved. In other words, it takes just as long to skin a 2 ounce fish as it does to skin a 1 pound fish.
Right.
So you got to skin 8 of the 2 ounce fish to equal the 1 of the so
your time.
Yeah.
Which is really valuable.
Right. So that's what we try to do. And again, the different type of bait also dictates the size fish you catch.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, see, I was telling you back whenever Daddy used to fish. In the wintertime, Daddy would always use what we call cut bait. Cut bait is herring or shad, like Jerome was catching.
Yeah.
Okay? You would sour that herring or shad.
Let
or
it
spoil. Pogies, yeah.
Yeah.
And use that for bait. Now, that traditionally caught those big channel cats like this. Big fish. What I was telling you about, Daddy would take the hook pole and it would telegraph and the thing would come up.
Yeah.
Now, those were the big channel cats that would do it.
Really?
And he loved to catch those. And that's what he would go every when the water turned cold and the crab slacked off. Mm-hmm. That's one of the disadvantages of using the cut bait, is because the crabs like it. But anyway, he would always use a cut bait, and he would catch the bigger fish. But we don't use cut bait much anymore. Cost prohibitive because of the cost of the cut bait anymore, and availability, it's not as available as used to be. See, back when they were haul seining, you would get what they call the river herring, and you could get that for almost nothing, and that was a good bait, but you just don't do it anymore. So anyway.
So the soybeans then?
Soybeans got,
get smaller?
Smaller,
fish?
Yeah. You get a smaller fish with the soybean. Now, there are two different types of soybean process that we get. We get the soybean chips, and then we get the soybean cakes, and that's the 3 feet sheet by 1 feet. The pieces that you saw up there last night, the slab looking stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what they call a cake bait. Same thing, same soybean, but it's processed different. That catches a smaller fish than the chips, even though it's the same stuff.
That's funny.
I don't understand it either. And when you put it in the water, it takes on a different odor. However, it's the same stuff, still same soybeans. Huh. But the processing is the only thing that's different in it. So anyway, that catches even smaller fish historically.
Hmm.
Okay. But you come back in with the fish, and again, depending on how many fish you have, depends on how long it takes to clean. And then you clean up, after that, clean up, and depending on whatever else is going, for example, if the eel pots were due to be run, and we had enough time left, well, I'd go out and run the eel pots, but if not, I would start building up crab pots or repairing fish traps. I started to say even building new fish traps, but it's been so long since I've built any new fish traps.
Wow.
I say long. It's been a couple of years since I built them. It's so involved in getting into the trap, fish trap building. So many different pieces you got to get together. It's kind of, when so many other things are going on, it's hard to just sit down and say, okay, I'm going to build a fish trap. It's kind of hard to do that because you invest so much time in it, and you think, well, if I wasn't doing this, I could be doing this. I could,
yeah.
I could build 5 crab pots in the amount of time it's going to take me to build one of these, and so forth and so on. So I figure out, well, I say, I've got enough fish traps now, so I don't really need those. Those aren't pressing. However, I don't have enough crab pots, so I feel that my time is better spent. Yeah. But anyway, it takes up all of the daylight hours and sometimes into the night on the operation. Yeah.
Well, so do you have a lot of trouble with crabs getting into your fish traps?
Not during the winter, because crabs slack up so much. Now, for example, the other day when you was here, I'd pulled all those traps, and I think I had 2 crabs in there.
Little ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Real little.
Because they're mostly all little now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And you were saying that you can fish 80 traps off a license.
Mm-hmm.
Could, if you wanted to, could you have Cindy get a license?
Yes.
And then you could have one.
That's what we do.
And that's so that is what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's could you get licenses for your boys?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there'd be a way to run a lot more.
Yeah. And if you were physically able to do it now,
physically,
there's a limit to what. Yeah. You just couldn't put 500 traps out there and run them. You just can't do it. It's basically self-limiting, because let's face it, you can only rob so many banks.
Really?
No, that's not a good likeness. But
so much work. I wanted to ask if your dad ever used wooden fish traps.
No, Dad never did, but I did.
You did.
I tried them. Yeah. I had this boy. I was going to get rich. I knew that during spawning that catfish like to find a hole to go in. And I saw these wooden slat traps, and I said, "Gosh, I got to have some of those." So I ordered some, and they come, and I took them and went and put them out in the creek, Dunn's Creek down here, and I just knew that they was going to load up, but they didn't catch. Now, I don't know whether it's I wasn't familiar enough with it to make them catch or just what it was, but I never did get them to catch.
Now, where did you order them from?
Let's see. Yeah, as a matter of fact, Memphis Nylon, was it Nylon Net Company I ordered them from,
See, because in the Tennessee River, you can't fish with wire traps. You can only fish with wooden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is this one of the only rivers around where you can fish
wire traps? Yeah, the St. John's is very few. You can fish some in the St. Mary's. But the St. John's is, it's the most fished with wire traps, with anybody.
Now, if you wanted to use wooden, then here you could, of
You
course.
Could, but you're limited. You can only use 15.
Now, why is that?
I have no idea. But you couldn't pull many more than 15 of those rascals.
Because
they are so
heavy.
They are.
Because I was wondering why nobody used wooden traps.
But they're just
you can
not
use something better.
Yeah.
Is why.
Yeah, why?
Another reason
that's
you use wooden ones in the Tennessee would be because you can't use
anything.
The wire ones. Yeah. Okay. Because that was funny. I was talking to a friend of mine last night who had worked on the Tennessee River with fishermen, and he was asking, you can use wire traps there?
Yeah.
It's a big surprise. Because people in the Tennessee, there are all these different varieties of wooden traps.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real everyone has their own real different looking design. The same with the wire here.
Yeah.
Now, so people have been using wire traps ever since you can remember.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So there really wasn't a wooden trap tradition here.
No,
probably.
No, there wasn't.
That's really interesting.
Now, out in the panhandle, in the panhandle section of the state, that's what they use is the wooden trap, because they can't use wire out there.
Well, how would you make a living only running a few of the wooden ones?
I have no idea. I don't see that you could. I really don't.
Yeah. Can they can use cat lines too, though, right?
Some portions of the state you can, yeah.
Mm.
Those also are regulated. You can't just go anywhere and put out a cat line. You can't. You can in this country, in the St. John's River country. You can, of course. But
then
you get in the other bodies of water, no, you can't. You can't just go and do. Certain places are restricted to what you can do. Well, every place is restricted as far as that goes to what you can and can't do.
Hmm.
Yeah. And, gosh, we've got a rules and regulation book that's about 3/4 inch thick, one of those code book things. And
that's
really restricted.
You really have to know.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of restrictions, you were talking last night about how your dad made fish traps, of course, and how you make them. And I wonder how your dad's fish traps changed after regulations. Did the trap he made essentially change to respond to the different regulations that came down?
No, the regulations responded to the trap.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Regulations were made because that was the basic trap that people were using.
So the regulations didn't do things like say that the mesh had to be wire or so they pretty much followed what was going on instead of trying to dictate.
They made a one inch mesh minimum. That's the minimum wire that you can fish for catfish is 1 inch.
Because otherwise you'd catch
stuff like
things.
Yeah. And I may have left that out when I was talking to you earlier about regulations on the trap, but there is a size minimum, which is 1 inch, and that's what we've always used is one inch mesh wire, and
that's interesting. And Mr. Schmidt, Jerome Schmidt, had a trap that I'd never seen. It had a for the throat. It had nylon
webbing on it.
Now, is that his particular designer, is that more common? I just haven't seen it.
It's more common in running water. I think that's a design that came out of the hook net fishery, where they found out that they could attach webbing to the wire throat and make it as efficient as a hook net in running water. And then the fish wouldn't have an escape hole to get back out of. They wouldn't have the wire throat to contend with. Some people use the webbing throat. That's a popular, I believe up in South Carolina, that's a popular type fish trap, is with the webbing throat. Now, there's not a lot of people around here that use the webbing throat fish trap. I tried a couple myself, and I was not satisfied with the performance. Yeah, I couldn't get them to catch for me. So I don't use them.
Right.
And that's not been a traditional type either. I mean, that's something that's just come about within the last few years, is the webbing throats on the wire.
Because he had a bunch of them.
I was surprised. Yeah.
I guess they work for him.
Well, they do work for some people, I guess. But
the area he's in is.
Well, see, he's in the flowing water up there in the river, and again in the flowing water. Fish traps don't, with the trap door, traditional trap door, does not work well in flowing water.
So you don't have that problem here?
No, we don't have a flow out here as such. It's basically still water.
Yeah. Except when it's rough like
Except
this.
When it's like it is out there now. It's not very still out there today. Yeah.
Well, the other question, I was thinking about changes that you've seen in the lake and in the St. John's in terms of how it's different now from when you were growing up and fishing on it, pollution-wise and maybe the variety of fish that you're catching, if that has changed at all.
The biggest change, as far as I'm concerned, is people. that's been the biggest change on the waterways, is there are just so many people that are living on the water. Everybody wants to live on the water. So much development on it.
Yeah.
All of that contributes to the detriment of the water quality and the whole business. And I just don't believe people realize. But anyway, I've seen the invasion of hydrilla,
which is
a foreign weed to the aquatic weed. That's gonna make water hyacinths look like Sunday school.
Dave Sheffield said that he had seen a time when the water hyacinths went all the way across the St. John's.
I have too. I've been up there in it whenever it was all the way across. It looked like
a
pasture.
I just couldn't believe that. I mean, not that I doubted it, but That just seems amazing.
Yeah, there at the bridge at Palatka, you could not see one speck of water anywhere, both sides. Solid green from one side of the river to the other. We used to have a lot of hyacinths out here, but between the Army Corps of Engineers spraying and killing the hyacinths with their spray and the cold weather, they've just about taken care of the hyacinths. But yeah, gosh, back in the 50s, wow, water hyacinth was a real problem. There would be times when the river would just absolutely be choked off with water hyacinths. You couldn't get out on the water. They would be so mean.
How would you fish then?
You don't fish when it's like that. You wait for the wind or the tide or whatever to shift and break them up. Yeah. There's been times when of course, now that's not the entire stretch of the river. That's just at particular bottlenecks that you would see this if the wind was blowing in the right direction and the tide was going in the right direction, where you had all of these elements working at the same time, they would bunch up in places. Now, we've actually followed tugboats with our kicker boats to get through the things.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. But for their
little
fish tanks. They were brought in for the aquariums, fish tanks, and they decided they didn't no longer want it, so they threw it out the door into the water, and that's the consequence when it got started. But it attaches to the bottom. It has roots, and it's attached to the bottom. And I've read articles on it, and under the proper conditions, hydrilla can grow at a rate of 1 inch per day and can reach maximum lengths of 50 feet.
No.
It can have stems 50 feet long.
No.
This is National Geographic's article. I feel they do enough research on their articles that you can pretty well believe it. But anyway, hydrilla will eventually take over, ruin the eelgrass. We'll no longer have eelgrass. I feel this is coming about. Because when hydrilla gets in, it shades, it grows to the top, and then when it gets to the top, it just masses out in huge masses. And it will shade out the eelgrass. We'll no longer have the eelgrass beds. Mm-hmm. And so thick, it's ridiculous. Yeah.
How could you get rid of it?
You can't get rid of it. They're doing some experiments with chemicals to control it, but I don't believe they'll ever eradicate it. It just never will be done. If they do, there's another chemical that we're putting in the water, like the chemical they use to spray the hyacinths. All that is a nutrient, an enrichment, and you've got other problems whenever you do that. You add another element to the water.
What did they spray the hyacinths with?
2,4-D. Yeah. It's herbicide. It actually accelerates the growth of the hyacinth, and it grows itself to death.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Sure.
Oh, that's real interesting.
Grows itself to death.
Huh. Now, did that 2,4-D stuff kill the eelgrass, too?
It didn't kill the eelgrass. 2,4-D, the herbicide, has to be put directly on the plant leaf. It's absorbed through that, through the leaf. It doesn't necessarily kill the eelgrass by coming in contact, because it just don't. But what it does is it kills that mass of hyacinths. Then the hyacinths fall on top of the eelgrass, shade out the sunlight, and consequently kills the beds of eelgrass.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That sounds bad.
Yeah.
A lot of people have told me that they think the river is muddier.
It is
now.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Yeah.
Okay.
You can go to any of the back tides where the tide doesn't get a swift flow to carry it on out, and the whole cove will just be solid mud.
Is most of that from the dead hyacinths? Or?
No, it's runoff basically from development. That's my theory.
Stuff too, maybe.
Well,
more development.
I believe more development than agriculture, because I don't think there's that much agriculture that goes on right close enough to the water to have that much effect. Now, in Apopka, Lake Apopka, and those other inland lakes over there, yeah, agriculture definitely is the problem there. But I don't think so on the St. John's, because you don't have that much agriculture development. By that, I mean you don't have a guy going in there and just plowing
right next
strip after strip next to the St. John's. I don't know of any place up and down the river where there's a farm that does actual plowing, with the exception of Hastings. In that area north, they do.
But that, yeah.
And I'm not real familiar with that area
yeah.
up in there. But
well, that's the only big agriculture for mm-hmm. plowing
yeah.
that's around.
Is up there,
part.
Yeah. And that could have some effect. But I go back to the same thing. People and the guy coming in and then buying mm-hmm. a riverfront or lakefront lot, the first thing he wants to do is clear everything on it, get in the bulldozer and push up the trees. And then he has field dirt hauled in, and then you rent. This guy next door, I'll give you a prime example. Before he put up his bulkhead, he brought in $400 worth of field dirt over there.
Wow.
Put it on his front, and we had torrential rains that same week, and every bit of his field dirt wound up in the lake. We sat here and watched it just take every bit of it right out into the lake. Then we sent it. We would just... Yeah, and just sat here and watched it that week. It just rained and rained, and it took every bit of it right out into the lake. But anyway,
so you just think of how many times that's happening
over the
over
the period of time that the development started around the riverfront and lakefront.
It's people that don't understand. These people are from Honolulu, and it's people that don't understand what they're doing.
Yeah. But anyway, that is. Now, I may be way off in left field about that, but logic tells me after seeing it in this little development right here, when you couple that with the stretches of the St. John that has been developed lately,
mm-hmm.
and the reduction of the floodplain at the headwaters of the St. John's, all of those factors contribute to me to the...
Well, it makes sense.
...to the mud. Now, this Dunn's Creek deal up there where they got all those doggone canals and where they went in and dug, that killed Dunn's Creek. The guys that used to fish nets in there, they
had to leave.
They just can't fish nets in there anymore because of the mud problem. They put the nets out and the mud silt comes in and it just hangs all over the nets, and they don't catch the fish that they used to catch in there. And gosh, they put their nets out, and next week they got to take them up and dry them and get the mud off of them. It's just that fine, silty. And it's suspended. It's not just on the bottom. It's suspended in the water. And whatever, the webbing that it comes in contact with, it just sticks to it. So anyway.
Well, how about the development? Was it like in the 60s that this place got to be built?
That's the explosion. Yeah, it started in the 60s. Yeah.
Just mostly retirees?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a big impact on an area that I guess was pretty much undeveloped.
This area was like the only place that was on this side of the lake was the log cabin that used to be here. That was it as far as lakefront. This was all pasture land all back through here. The guy that owned this runs scrub cows all through here, and then he sold it out, and then they started digging ditches and draining. See? And they drained
it.
So
this used to be swamp here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know.
All this back down in here. Gosh, all this back down here was wet. Yeah.
Oh.
You see right across the road over here, this little bay head? We get a half an inch of rain, and this guy's underwater over here.
Wow.
Yeah.
You get a half inch of rain pretty regularly down here in the summer, I guess.
Yeah. So,
well, there he is again.
Yeah. He's going to hang around until he gets some.
He was down there eating catfish head. Did you feed him yet this morning?
No, I left an old mullet head out there yesterday for him.
He was having trouble getting
the fin. Where he got it?
I thought you had drunk.
No, I haven't been down there. Give him.
Maybe he went in the cooler and got it.
Maybe he did. Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think's going to happen in the next 10 or 15 years here? It's hard to tell, but
it really is, because it changes almost daily now. Gosh, like I was telling you, for example, when Daddy was fishing, how clean the bottom of the lake was. You didn't have the growth problem with the funguses and the algae and the so forth, from the silts. He would put his traps out in September, take his traps up in June, and would not take his traps up any time period between September and June. Mm-hmm. He fished the same traps year that whole season. Never had to take them out and clean them or anything. The only reason he took them out is because that was the end of the season and the traps had rusted. Now, within 10 days, there is already a fungus attaching itself to the traps. Mm. And within 2 to 3 weeks, you have an actual algae growing on the wire. Mm. I don't know what the name of it is, but it's a hairy stuff that grows in the water. And you constantly have to keep changing, bringing in the ones that get growed up and getting that stuff
on.
We scrub. We bring them in and dry them, and then we brush this growth off before we put them in the tar. I'll tell you why. Because if you don't brush that growth off, and you put it in the tar and mm-hmm. tar the trap, or you don't beat that growth off in the tar. If you tar over that growth, when you put it back out, that growth will come out of the tar. It will actually grow through the tar. I've seen that. Yeah.
That's really amazing that it would survive.
Survive that hot tar. Yeah, yeah. And it will actually continue growing through that. So when we come bring them in, we dry them and brush them and tar them and then put them back out.
So how often are you running that tar pot when you're busy?
Weather plays more of a role in when I fire the pot. As you can see, the way the wind is blowing today, we certainly wouldn't want to go down there and fire the tar pot today and have the smoke fill up
right into the house. Yeah.
So we try to catch when the wind is blowing any other direction and when it's fairly warm. I need to tar right now, mm-hmm. but I can't because of the weather. Because I need the fresh traps. But that's what I do is when I change out all of my fresh traps and then I have all dirty traps on the hill,
yeah.
I try to tar up those dirty ones.
Yeah.
As soon as they're dry and clean enough that I can tar them and weather conditions are right.
So do you end up doing it like every 6 weeks or longer?
During the busy season, I would say on the average, I don't go more than 6 weeks without firing the pot. Yeah. Sometimes it's more often than that, depending on how fast the traps get dirty. There was a time when I was tarring every week. I would tar one day every week.
Wow.
Of course, that goes back to the point of when I was first getting started and I didn't have enough equipment where I could keep changed out.
Now you have a margin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I have a buffer zone there where I can.
How many people still use a hot tar process around here?
Oh, goodness.
Do you think?
Hmm. I don't have any idea who still uses hot tar. I just don't know.
Hmm. Do you think it's a lot less common now than 10 years
Definitely
ago?
Definitely is. Definitely is. Yeah.
Because maybe I told you Morris Bryan's tar pot. He said that he used to run it and would have people come up there mm-hmm. to dip their hoop nets mm-hmm. and just pitch in for the tar, mm-hmm. and sort of like a public service.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that maybe that was because people didn't want to run their own tar pot anymore and they would just use.
Yeah. Him. No, for the hoop nets, now you have a different thing because you got to have a big round one for the hoop nets.
Yeah, his is
huge,
it's
right? Big, yeah.
It's like 7 feet
across.
Yeah. I mean,
did you see some of Doc Bennett's 7-foot nets?
No, I didn't.
You should have seen some of those. Boy, he could stand in the throat of those things.
Oh, great.
And they were mounted,
The
like
biggest
that.
I've seen is 5 feet.
Well, that's the limit now. That's as big as you can fish. The law, the rules changed, and 5 feet is the largest you can fish now.
I'll have to get up with Doc Bennett again and see that.
Yeah.
A 7-foot. That would be quite a thing to see. I'm supposed to see Jackie next week.
Yeah.
Maybe he could show me one. That's neat.
Yeah, it's 6- and 7-footers. Gosh, they were huge. Thank golly. You could drive a truck in them, look like.
Oh, golly. Doc Bennett can't be a whole lot taller than me. How tall is he?
I don't know.
Six or seven?
He's
kind of
small.
Small man,
yeah.
Yeah.
He's small.
That'd be pretty funny to see him standing in the throat of one of those.
I saw that. I never did see it. I saw it in the paper.
In paper?
The paper did an article on him a few years back. Did an article on Doc Bennett. Okay. And that's where I saw it. They had the picture of him standing in the throat of this.
That is great. That,
wow. You know.
When did those regulations change that you couldn't have them that big?
Just within the last two or three years.
Oh.
Yeah.
So they're constantly,
they're constantly changing regulations. They change regulations every year. But the ones that changed the size thing was just within the last 3 years, I think, that the size was changed on the hoop nets. Because they had come, the Game Commission had come to the commercial fishing and found out that there was very few large nets being fished anyway.
Mm.
And they was trying to get a uniform regulation.
Right.
And so they
decided
to do fine.
That tarpot, I'm really interested in how those work. Maybe when you fire yours up, I could come down and take some pictures. That would be
okay.
Okay.
Yeah. As soon as the wind goes south again, we're gonna
and
fire.
And away from the house. Yeah.
I tell you, we're modern now with our shucks. We got natural gas to fire it with and a whole bit.
Oh,
we
so
used
much
to,
easier.
Yeah, we used to fire with lighter knots. Oh,
really?
Yeah,
oh, God. Wow.
We first, not Cindy and I, of course, but Daddy, he used to fire with lighter knots when I was a kid. And probably the most frightening thing is to see a tar pot on fire with the fire burning the tar. That's a hairy experience. And believe me, we've seen plenty over the years.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that sounds so scary.
I remember the first tar pot we ever had. Daddy had taken some 55-gallon drums and split them and had them welded together, and that was our tar pot, was drums split and welded together. And we poured the tar in there, and we didn't know anything about tar. I say we, now I'm talking Daddy because I was probably 8 or 9 years old at the time. And we set the tar pot up in the backyard. And this is when we was living away from the lake. Of course, Daddy always lived away from the lake, with the exception of 1 year. But anyway, he lived, and we set the tar pot up in the backyard. And over the years, I've decided that there was either water in the tar when we put it in the pot, or we got water in the pot somehow or other. Because the thing about tar is when you heat tar, it becomes real thin, and if there's any water or in the tar, it will expand. It will foam up, create a foam. And what happened was we were firing with wood, and we got our fire too hot. The tar became too thin and foamed, and that's when I deducted somehow or other there must have been water in there. But at the time, we wasn't aware of it, see. And this is I found out from my own experiences over the years watching how tar performs in there. But anyway, something... we got it too hot, and the tar expanded, and it came over the tar pot, and the whole thing become a blaze. Well, there again, Daddy not being familiar with the tar and what was going on, he started pouring water on it.
Oh,
and the more water he poured on it, the bigger the thing got, the more flames, and the black smoke was just billowing out, and those old hot flames were just going everywhere. Gosh, they must have been 25 feet in the air.
Oh, you must have been petrified to be 9 years old and watch this happen.
And it was right at the back door.
Oh, no.
And the black smoke was going in the house, and it was just shrouded the house and the whole... And the best that I remember from that experience was that whole vat of tar burned up sitting right there in the backyard. The whole interior of the house was soot black. Ma was so upset. I'll never forget that.
And she was really upset.
God, the thing that I remember was all we could do was, after we decided that, or Daddy decided that water wasn't going to put it out, was just sit there and watch the thing burn itself out. And it burned up that whole vat of tar. which was probably a drum and a half or two drums of tar.
A lot of money.
At that time, well, it was cheap, but it's still now basically the same. But anyway.
I can't imagine. You must have been just terrified. Gosh.
And from that time on, the worst fear that you can have is your tar pot catching on fire. And I've had that one there on fire several times. But we, with the gas, say all you do is you shut the valve off and then you throw the cover over the pot and smother it out.
So it's not a big problem.
Yeah, back then you couldn't do that because those lighter knots up under that pot, they were just blazing. They would blaze for a day. And then you got all that tar too. But anyway.
Oh, that is really...
That was a horrible experience.
Terrifying story. Oh, your mother must have just been ready to die. Have all that black smoke in the house and worried that her husband and her sons were going to come in flames in the backyard. That must have been with those flames going up high. Gosh,
yeah,
it was just an incredible sight.
It is. And that stuff comes ablaze just like that. When it gets thin, like you have to have it thin to dip the trap.
Yeah.
If you get it too thick, if you don't get it hot enough and it's too thick, then it coats the trap too thick. You got this great big glob up, not great big, but you got a big coating of tar on the trap. And I myself don't like big coating on the tar or on the trap. I like
Does it
thin.
Affect the fish?
To me it does.
Yeah.
But then again, this is my...
Sure.
Yeah.
So you've never, since you don't use hoop nets, you've never had to have a big...
No,
hot.
No.
You can just use a small.
Yeah,
one.
This is the extent. Yeah.
Because that one on Morris Brian's, I just
had.
Yeah,
it's huge.
You know, I've never seen a hoop net dipped. I didn't even know they did that. I would love to see one because it must be such a process to dip that huge old thing in.
They don't do it. Yeah, they don't do it anymore like that though.
They don't.
No, they don't do it.
Do they use a cold process now?
Yeah, it's called net coat, and all it is it's just an asphalt type liquid. And they add gasoline to it to thin it, and they get it to a real thin consistency. And they just take the net and just drop the. Those are collapsible. The hook nets.
Yeah, right.
They just collapse the whole thing right down, and they probably won't have more than 6 or 8 inches of liquid in the bottom of their vat now. And most of the vats now consist of those cattle watering troughs, those big cattle watering troughs, the round ones, and. They just collapse the whole thing right down in that liquid, and then it absorbs.
Uh-huh.
It absorbs, and most of them don't even hang them up anymore. The ones that I've watched tar their nets is they just take the net and put it in there and pick the net up over the vat and hold it over the vat and give it a quick shake to shake off the excess, and then they stretch it out on the dirt or grass, putting in or wherever, but they no longer hang them up and let them drip dry the way they used to because with the gasoline and the new thing, it's dry almost like that.
That's funny. I was just thinking it would all sort of stick together and all.
No,
but
no,
they don't.
They got it so thin that it doesn't. Now with the old style, with the old hot tar that they used to dip in, if you wasn't careful. You had to stretch it out to stretch the mash open because as soon as it got cold, it was like, it had to stick together.
Morris Bryan said he'd have them all hung up and they had a cure for 3 or 4 days before you
to
could
dry.
Put them in
the
water.
Yeah, yeah, because the tar would stay soft and still sticky. Yeah, it would take 3 days at least to get it where you could handle it without getting tar all over everything.
Gosh, that's really...
Yeah.
I wish I'd been here 10 years ago to see him operating that tar pot with a whole
Well, now, they still use the hot tar for netting in Fernandina.
Now, where's that?
Fernandina Beach, north of Jacksonville up there.
Oh, huh.
But
Fernandina.
As a matter of fact, that's where all the coal tar in the southeast comes from, is out of Fernandina. Huh. Fernandina brings it down... standard hardware and marine, or standard marine and hardware in Fernandina, has it shipped down by tank car, and then they put it in drums there at Fernandina, and then they ship it to all points in the southeast. That's the central distribution place for the southeast. I buy mine through Jacksonville Fisherman Supply. They, in turn, buy it from Standard Marine in Fernandina. So it goes Standard Marine, Jackson Fisherman Supply, and then me. But they use it, and I've talked to them about the tar method, and you have to be very careful when you're dipping webbing in the hot tar, because it'll shrink the webbing.
Oh yeah, if it's too
if it's too hot,
yeah.
And it will harden. Mm-hmm. Mine, for example, is hard as a brick right now. The tar in my pot is hard as this tabletop. Just like if you go down and break it, it'd look just like a chunk of coal.
Yeah.
And then when I heat it, then it becomes liquid again. Now that's because I heat mine so hot that something cooks out of the tar that causes it to crystallize like that. Hmm. At Fernandina, they never get theirs that hot. They say that the ideal temperature for net dipping is 187 degrees.
Okay.
And ours gets much hotter than that. We boil ours, actually bring ours to a boil before we dip the traps in it. You couldn't do it with net. If you put net in boiling tar, your net would go...
and you'd just have this little nylon mask.
You'd have a nylon glove. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Not so, too good.
Yeah. So anyway, we... and periodically we have to keep adding new tar to keep out, because it becomes so brittle when you put it on the traps, when you dip the traps and you put it... If you just handle the trap too rough, then the tar starts breaking off.
And chip off.
Yeah, yeah. And it becomes too brittle, and consequently, you have to add new tar to get it back to a sticky. Yeah.
Wow. Here he comes again.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about all the different things that a fisherman has to know, you know, in order to be good and even, well, in order to make a living. What do you think are sort of some personal qualities that a good fisherman has, or...
You've got to like to fish to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to enjoy what you're doing. You've got to be persistent, patient.
That was the one I was thinking of. Patience.
And you've got to have some good help. A fisherman, fishing alone is in deep trouble. Other than that, I think those qualities are probably most important. Number one being, of course, enjoyment. You have to enjoy it. You get some self-satisfaction outside of the monetary aspect.
You have to. There must be other ways to make a
living. Oh, gosh, yeah. You go down here and hire on at the... wherever, the factory or the pulp mill or whatever, you got the security, you know your check's going to be there, you got insurance, you don't worry about all of these small, you don't worry that the wind's going to blow tomorrow, you don't worry that there's not going to be no fish in your pot, in your trap, you don't worry about your motor's going to break down, or all of that stuff. In this business, you got headache upon headache upon headache, worry. You put the bait out there and you take the big gamble that you're going to catch fish. A lot of times you go out, you don't have fish. You go in the hole for bait. You don't make even gas money, let alone bait bill. So all of these things contribute. That's why I say you have to enjoy it to do it. And you have to have some background in it. You can't just be a man off the street with no knowledge of fishing and go out and make a living at it. I just don't think anybody can do it.
Would you say that most of the people making a living commercial fishing now that you know, the majority of them grew up
had
on
had some background in fishing. Now, there are a few exceptions, but those few exceptions, had it not been for other means of support, would not... I don't believe would be in fishing today.
Yeah.
Most of the hardcore fisherman. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy that's really in there to to get a living out of it had some background in fishing. Either his family fished or he, like in Robbie's case, he grew up friends with a fishing family and got bits and pieces of information. And through his own experiences with a fishing family, like going out in the boat with the basically my younger brothers who he hanged around with all the time, and they went out in the boat together, and Robbie learned through that experience, and then he got into it a little, like he was working at the pulp mill, Robbie was, and he fished part-time and accumulated experience through that method, and then eventually became a full-time fisherman. By that I mean he gave up jobs. However, there have been periods when fishermen would have to go out and get another job to supplement, to get him over the lean times. Gosh, I remember one time back in the late 50s, early 60s, when most everybody that was a commercial fisherman had to go out and get a job. Charles Butler, probably.
I can hardly imagine.
Probably the best fisherman during that period of time had to go, he went to work at the pulp mill. I was working at the pulp mill. Wally Solana, I think, was working at the pulp. Now, I'm talking about guys who was raised right there in Malacca, had hook nets and trot line, the whole ball of wax, and still had to go out and get a job. The catfish were just non-existent at that period of time. And I blame it on the years of monkey fishing prior to that time. Everybody in the world seemed like was monkey fishing in the mid-50s. We was doing it. You could go to Lake George at times in the summertime. Now, the summertime is the only time, spring and summer and fall, when the water's warm, is the only time that the monkey works. It doesn't work during cold water.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Right. It doesn't work in still water. It has to be moving water. We don't know why, but I've asked several biologists what their logic was, why they thought what made the machine work, and I have different opinions on that. But anyway, we don't know what it does. And we don't know why it only affected catfish. No other species of fish. Only catfish.
That's interesting.
But anyway,